This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm Bethany Chafin. Melody Moisey is an Iranian-American lawyer, activist, and award-winning author. Her latest book is titled Haldol and Hyacinths, A Bipolar Life. The memoir chronicles Melody's road to a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. In it, she talks about an early battle with pancreatitis, she addresses psychotic breaks and manic episodes, details the project of writing her first book, War on Error, Real Stories of American Muslims, and comments on the stigma associated with mental illness. Melody brings out the humor and humanity in it all. The book was recently released in paperback, and this month, July, is Minority Mental Health Awareness Month. I spoke with Melody from her home in Raleigh. I'd like it if, for our listeners, you could elaborate on the title, Haldol and Hyacinths, and tell us why these two words particularly pair well for what you're expressing in your book.
Thank you so much for having me on, first off. And secondly, the title of the book, and I'm glad you pronounced it correctly, Haldol is an antipsychotic, and it was the first drug that actually brought me out of psychosis when I was in my worst state. I had an acute manic episode and a psychotic break. Hyacinths are actually one of my favorite flowers, but on top of that, they're highly representative. In Iranian culture, in Persian culture, we have our new year in March, and part of the spread for the new year, we call it a half seen, which translates to seven S's. And one of those scenes, one of those S's is sombol, which means hyacinths. And that represents rebirth for the new year, which again is the first day of spring. So those two things, the idea of rebirth, and also this one drug that finally pulled me out of psychosis. It's not something I take every day at all, but it was the one thing that first worked for me to bring me back to reality. So those two things together have meaning in that sense.
And could you tell us a bit about the span of the book and what time period it covers? And chronologically, it moves around a bit, but that's sort of important for the way you're telling this story. Could you just give us a short synopsis for our listeners?
Sure. Yeah. Mostly it started for me, my first episode of depression was when I was in high school, and that was about my junior year in high school. But mostly this is, the book covers the time period where things started getting bad for me. And I was, like most people with bipolar disorder, I was misdiagnosed for an extended period of time. For most people, it takes 8 to 10 years to get a proper diagnosis. It took me 10 years to get a proper diagnosis. I was improperly diagnosed and at some points improperly medicated for unipolar depression. And unfortunately, the medication for that can exacerbate bipolar disorder if you're taking just antidepressants without a mood stabilizer. And that was the case for me at certain points. So at any rate, it covers that time and through college and high school, a little bit of high school, college, and also law school. And after that, I got a master's in public health and started writing when I realized the legal system worked and moved a lot more slowly than I was willing to tolerate. So, and then I became a writer full time. And it covers an acute psychotic break, as I mentioned, before I actually got a proper diagnosis. And that took 3 hospitalizations.
That's one of the things I thought was really captivating about your book was you're very honest about how you were choosing your healthcare providers and about how well-educated and loving your family is and Matthew, your spouse. But even with all of that, you know, what you say about how long it took to have a proper diagnosis made, knowing that, what is your advice then perhaps to someone who is trying to choose a healthcare provider? And even though you said you chose someone who was calm and had wonderful credentials, what do you tell people to look for?
Yeah, well, that's the thing about advice. I would never trust one person for anything. Imagine if you had cancer. Would you trust one diagnosis? I wouldn't. And even though it may cost more money up front, and it will, to get a second, third, fourth opinion, it's worth it. Because if you're misdiagnosed for 10 years, you could get even worse. And in some cases, you can't go back from that. Now I'm at a point, if I caught this illness early on, I could have caught it in what they call bipolar 2, before I had hallucinations and delusions and things like that. But now that's happened. And once your brain has sort of gone to those places, it's easier to go back. So now my official diagnosis is bipolar 1, which is the most extreme form of the illness. So I think it's incredibly important to get a proper diagnosis early on. I'm so glad that you asked about it. sometimes other people living with the illness will be able to see things that physicians can't. And I write about it in the book with my first hospitalization after my first suicide attempt. A bunch of the other patients told me, you know, we think you're bipolar. We don't think you have depression because what happened to me and happens sometimes after suicide attempts and people with bipolar disorders, I sort of vaulted into a low-grade mania. And the patients caught it. The doctors didn't because they didn't see me enough. They weren't watching me enough. And when you're dealing with illnesses that are diagnosed based on talking to the patient and witnessing the patient's behavior, a 15-minute med check isn't going to cut it, you know? So I would say get as many opinions as you possibly can, even if it costs a lot to start off, because you may be saving money and definitely struggle and pain and suffering in the end by doing that upfront.
I mentioned Matthew, and you write about him as your rock, and then you say he's actually your boulder. And you know, one of the things you're talking about, the other patients being able to interact with you daily, obviously he knows you best, perhaps. And one of his ways of processing what you all were experiencing was by taking a lot of notes and being very meticulous, and that was his style. Could you tell me about how that probably now or then played into your writing of this book? Because you revisited some of those notes.
There, you know, depression, mania, and psychosis can do a number on your memory, and they do. Not to say, and I will say with psychosis in particular, a lot of people say you won't remember anything if you're in psychosis. And that is an argument for allowing the use of restraints in a way that I don't think is appropriate. I think it's a way of arguing for the use of solitary confinement, which I also think is inappropriate in most cases. I would say 99% of cases. So just because you think we'll forget, we may not. There are parts of my experiences in psychosis that I did not forget. But there was a great deal that I did forget, and that without those notes, I couldn't have written this book. I couldn't have known what really happened. I had to interview my family, and I found out a lot of things that were, I just didn't know. I really didn't, which is sort of terrifying. But at the same time, I think I have a better picture of what happened to me that I wouldn't have otherwise. And it helped me on the road to recovery just to have those notes and see what the symptoms were that I exhibited early on. And for me, some of those now I'm learning afterwards that some of those symptoms, I'm sort of lucky. I have hallucinations, for example, very early on when, with mania. That's a lucky thing for me because I can catch it very early. Most people, that doesn't happen. And I know they're hallucinations within the first 24 hours or so. And I have visual hallucinations, which are also really rare with bipolar. It's not quite as common to have visual hallucinations, but I do. So it makes it a little easier to catch it early on. It also makes it a little scarier. But once you get used to it, I think it makes it easier to manage the illness in a way that helps you be functional.
You mentioned an episode of mania, or, you know, you talk about actually about several in your book. And I found it interesting that mania in combination with, or a manic episode in combination with some of your passions and desires to be an activist, they actually sort of were working together for a while. And I found your chapter on hooping for peace really fascinating. I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit about some of the anecdotes that a reader would find in that chapter.
So when I first started exhibiting signs of what turned out to be acute mania, it was in 2008, and sort of the whole country was going through this Obama mania. And I was too, especially I was working towards stopping a potential bombing of Iran, and a potential war with my home country of Iran, where I was, where both my parents are from, and I'm from originally, though I was born in the States. But basically the whole idea behind this organization that I founded that I thought was brilliant, I called it Hooping for Peace. And I started hula hooping literally for peace, and I started this organization, and we went to the Democratic National Convention. By we, I mean me and my husband in a car with lots of hula hoops, and invited people to come and hula hoop for peace. And at that point, I was mildly delusional in that I actually thought hula hooping could bring about peace, and it didn't help that I got a lot of media attention for it. And it sort of fed into all of that thinking that I could change things. But at the same time, I've always sort of been mildly delusional. And I think to be an activist and consistently stay one throughout your entire life, you have to be mildly delusional to really believe that one person can change the world, which I really do. I genuinely believe that. And I still believe that. Not necessarily through hula hooping and not necessarily in the way that I believed it in that moment, but to say that these sort of mild delusions haven't helped me in my life would be insincere, because I think that they have. And I write in the book about how delusions of grandeur aren't really delusions of grandeur if you meet them at a certain point. In many cases in my life, I was told that there were things that I couldn't do that were impossible. And especially after I was diagnosed, I was told to lower my expectations for my life, that I couldn't expect the things not only that I wanted to do after that point, but the things that I'd already achieved. One of the hospitals, over and over, they wrote in my files, patient has delusions that she's a lawyer and an author. So they weren't even able to sort out my delusions, you know. So part of writing this book for me was pointing out how broken our mental health system is. When we can't acknowledge the fact that very intelligent, bright people who are functional in the world and have something to contribute can also have a mental illness, a serious mental illness. And I know a lot of people who are way smarter than me, way more accomplished than I am, and who also live with serious mental illnesses but would never say it because of the stigma surrounding these diagnoses.
Well, and you mentioned there is a stigma in American society surrounding mental illnesses, but you also talk about the stigma surrounding mental illness in Iranian culture. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah, you know, and I faced, as being a member of a bunch of different so-called minorities, as an Iranian, as a Muslim, I experienced different kinds of stigma that I think, I guess, depending on where you're coming from, and I'm glad you bring this up because this month, July, is Minority Mental Health Month. I think to a certain extent, no matter where you're from and what your background is, you are going to have trouble if you're living with a mental illness, but it's sort of like suddenly you are given this double stigma. And in some cases more than that, depending on how many so-called minorities or historically marginalized communities to which you belong. And there's a sort of distrust that exists in a lot of minority communities with respect to the health profession and medicine. And both my parents are doctors, so you would think that distrust would not exist. But it did, and it did exist in my community to a certain extent, that it was possible that it could be just some sort of moral failing, that this wasn't actually an illness. Thankfully, in my case, my family, both my parents, caught on quickly. My husband caught on quickly. My sister is also a physician, caught on quickly. But there was a fear and said, this is a real illness. You need to take your medication, that kind of thing. So no one ever tried to send me to get an exorcism or anything like that, which I know people that things like that have happened to. But yeah, so my experience has just been that the stigma within the Iranian community is just as bad, and in some ways worse. We don't have a real name for some of these illnesses. We've just borrowed from other languages, and there's a kind of gossipy, in the diaspora in particular, it can be very gossipy, right? And this is with the Iranian community, the Pakistani community, a lot of immigrant communities, because we're smaller, right? So the fear was that other people would find out, and when they would, suddenly they wouldn't be, not only would they not be supportive, but they would start talking behind my back and judging me for it. But what I've found since I published the book, actually, is that I wish they had known. Because they would have been very supportive, now I'm realizing. And maybe part of it has to do with my having published this book and everything like that, and them being able to read so much about what my experience was. But I don't think that's it. I think part of it is also me projecting a level of stigma onto my community that didn't really exist, that wasn't as strong, at the very least, that wasn't as strong as I initially suspected.
One of the ways that you break the silence is with humor, at least, I think. And I found that really engaging. And I wonder if, you know, humor was something that helped you throughout, or humor has just always been kind of a way that you process and interact with the world.
Yeah, for me, it's my top survival mechanism. I would not be here without a sense of humor. And some of the things I wrote about in the book, and honestly, I mean, strip searches and things that were really dehumanizing, but at the same time, just hilarious in the moment, just thinking about it. When I write about, for example, in one of the hospitals, I was submitted to strip searches every day or every twice or three times a week, I think it was. Every time I saw my family afterwards, I had to do these strip searches. And early on, I realized that the people who were conducting it, there were about three nurses who were conducting it. And early on, I realized they were a lot more nervous than I was. And I used that to my advantage in a really manipulative way, and ended up just making them even more uncomfortable in the way that I was doing my strip search. For example, they would say, you don't actually need to take off your underwear, but I would do it and throw it at them. That was how vicious and horrible I was. But at the moment, like I should say, I was psychotic at some points. But you can't completely overlook the humor there. And if you do, I think it'll kill you. If you don't try and inject it into everything, at least for me, it was just something that the way that my brain works and the way that I cope with things.
So for someone who has recently been diagnosed as having bipolar disorder, what kind of advice or resources would you offer them?
I would really recommend that they look into their local DBSA or NAMI meetings, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or the Depression and Bipolar Support Alliance. These are amazing organizations. You don't have to pay anything, and you can go to support groups. I went religiously after I was first diagnosed to DBSA support groups in Atlanta, and I fully believe they helped save my life. Being able to learn from other people living with mental illness, there's no amount of money that can pay for that. It's just such an education, whether the people in your group are succeeding or failing in how they're dealing and coping with their illnesses. You just can learn so much. And it was just the best thing for me was to be able to go to those support groups. And I'm not the support group type of person. It took me a while to actually get interested. And my husband forced me to go to the first one. The first couple. So I would say that. I would also really like to share the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K, and to say that 20% of people with bipolar, up to 20% of us, end up taking our own lives. That's a serious issue, and if we're going to talk about, for example, gun control, which is the only time we seem to talk about mental illness is when there's some sort of mass shooting or something like that. But if we're going to talk about gun control and violence, people with mental illness are no more violent than the general population. When you control for substance abuse, we're actually much more likely to be victims of violent crime than the general population. And when you talk about gun control, 2/3 of all gun fatalities are suicides, and more than half of all suicides are gun-related, and there are twice as many suicides as there are homicides in this country. So if we want to be talking about those issues, we need to be talking about suicide, not homicide. We're not running out and killing people. We're not inherently violent. That's not an issue that you need to be worried about. What you need to be worried about is your own family members and the risk of suicide, because it is very high with these illnesses.
I don't want to see you disappear.
Activist, attorney, and author Melody Moisey. This Friday, Melody will discuss and read from her latest book, Haldol and Hyacinths, A Bipolar Life, at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro. The event is sponsored by the Mental Health Association in Greensboro, and it begins at 7 p.m. and goes until 8:30 p.m. Scuppernong is located at 304 South Elm Street in Greensboro. Melody's talk will be titled From Restraints to Recognition, Thriving with Mental Illness. The event is free and open to the public. For more information and a link to Melody's website, where you can read excerpts of her book and view her YouTube series, A Saner Spin on Crazy, visit our website at wfdd.org and click on Triad Arts Weekend.
This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a short break before returning with The Art of Chocolate, Rock Guitar, and Arts for Life next when Triad Arts Weekend continues.